We have Brother Tom Gilbert and his service is titled, as you can see, The Scripture of Nature.
Thank you and good evening, brethren. The title for our program is borrowed from the first episode of producer Ken Burns' outstanding PBS series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. Much of the historical information in this program is drawn from two sources: Inherit the Holy Mountain, Religion and the Rise of American Environmentalism, a book by Mark Stoll, and a 2016 issue of Christian History magazine that was focused on the wonders of creation. For centuries and ages, mankind has been in awe of the natural world around them. When they have taken the time to notice the small intricacies of living things and the majestic scenery of landscapes. In Psalm 19, David wrote, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world." Augustine of Hippo, commonly known today as Saint Augustine, wrote this: "Some people, in order to discover God, read books. But there is a great book, the very appearance of created things. Look above you, look below you. Note it, read it. God, whom you want to discover, never wrote that book with ink. Instead, he set before your eyes the things that he had made. Can you imagine, can you ask for a louder voice than that? Why, heaven and earth shout to you, God made me." Hugh of St. Victor, a Saxon theologian and head of the school at the Abbey of St. Victor in Paris, wrote, "The whole visible world is a book written by the finger of God." Martin Luther said, "God writes the gospel not in the Bible alone, but also on trees and in the flowers and clouds and stars." My parents took the family camping whenever there was a vacation time. I grew to love the outdoors and nature, and on one of those vacations in 1962, when I was 12, our parents took us out west to visit many of the national parks, and I decided then that I wanted to work for the National Park Service, and eventually I found myself doing so. But I remember clearly my disappointment in the scenery of Nebraska when my job with the National Park Service moved Janice and I to Omaha in 1981. Having grown up in Michigan with its extensive forests and many lakes and streams, I was disheartened by the relative lack of those things in Nebraska and the surrounding region. That is, until I was assigned to work on establishing the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail, following the route of their famous expedition, and I began to read the journals of Lewis and Clark. William Clark was rather pragmatic in his descriptions of what they did, what they encountered and saw. But Meriwether Lewis could wax poetic in his descriptions of the scenery and wildlife and plant life. It was not until I was able to see the lands that they traversed through his eyes that I began to appreciate the beauty of the prairies and high plains through which they passed. This is what Lewis wrote on May 31st, 1805. "The hills and river cliffs which we pass today exhibit a most romantic appearance. The bluffs of the river rise to the height of from 200 to 300 feet, and in most places nearly perpendicular. They are formed of remarkable white sandstone, which is sufficiently soft to give way readily to the impression of water. The water in the course of time has trickled down the soft sandstone cliffs and worn it into 1,000 grotesque figures, which, with the help of a little imagination and an oblique view at a distance, are made to represent elegant ranges of lofty freestone buildings, having their parapets well stocked with statuary. Columns of various sculpture, both grooved and plain, are also seen, supporting long galleries in front of those buildings. As we passed by, it seemed as if those scenes of visionary enchantment would never have an end. 2 weeks later, on June 13th, Lewis wrote this, "I had proceeded on about 2 miles when my ears were saluted with the agreeable sound of a fall of water, a roaring too tremendous to be mistaken for any cause short of the great falls of the Missouri. I wished that I might be enabled to give to the enlightened world some idea of this truly magnificent and sublimely grand object, which has from the commencement of time been concealed from the view of civilized man." Of course, Lewis and Clark and their men were visiting these, experiencing these lands in near pristine condition. But much of the beauty and wonder still remains today, despite human modifications to the landscape. It is specifically for the purpose of preserving unspoiled remnants of those landscapes that the United States began setting aside lands as national parks. The first national park set aside was Yellowstone in 1872. Others followed, such as Mackinac Island National Park in Michigan in 1875, Yosemite and Sequoia Parks in 1890, Mount Rainier in 1899, Crater Lake in 1902, Glacier National Park in Montana in 1910, and Rocky Mountain National Park in 1915. But there was no agency to take care of those places until the National Park Service was created in 1916. So 2 years ago, 2016, marked the 100th anniversary of the creation of the National Park Service. This year, 2018, is the 50th anniversary of the National Trail System, which currently consists of 11 National Scenic Trails and 19 National Historic Trails. And it was the National Trail System area that I worked in during my time. The legislation creating the Park Service said that the purpose of setting aside and managing these parks is to conserve the scenery and the natural and historic objects and the wildlife therein, and to provide for the enjoyment of the same in such manner and by such means as will leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. National parks open to the enjoyment of everyone was a totally new idea. It was something America, the United States, introduced to the world, and it is frequently referred to as America's best idea. If you explore the stories and histories of those who work to preserve these landscapes and the plant and animal life that inhabit them, we learn that they were motivated by their understanding of what these places communicate to us about God, about the character and power of our Creator. While today it is a popular notion that Christianity is opposed to conservation and environmental protection, the truth is that the National Parks Movement and the larger conservation and environmental movement were begun by people who were motivated by a desire to honor God. Those who worked to preserve these special places found their inspiration in 2 revelations from God, 2 books of Scripture, if you will, the Bible and the natural creation in which we dwell, with the revelations it contains about the nature, character, and power of God the Creator. God's written revelation points to this second book by way of the Apostle Paul in Romans 1, 19 and 20. "For what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." When we think of national parks, we often think of John Muir, who is known as the father of the national park system, not only for his campaign to protect Yosemite Valley, but his continued campaign to have the parks cared for in a manner that protects their natural and scenic values. John Muir was born in Scotland in 1838. In 1849, when he was 11, his family emigrated to the United States and settled in Wisconsin. John loved to spend time in the marshes and sedge meadows that were on their farm. His love of the natural world began there and heightened when he studied botany at the University of Wisconsin. Coming from a Scottish Presbyterian religious heritage, in America, the Muir family associated with neighbors as part of a Disciples of Christ congregation of the Restoration Movement begun by Thomas and Alexander Campbell. John's father, Daniel, sometimes served as the minister. He believed that anything that distracted from Bible study was a frivolous waste of time. He required his children to memorize Scripture, and consequently, by an early age, John could recite more than half of the Old Testament and all of the New Testament from memory. His religious upbringing and his love of all things nature merged to result in rhapsodic praise and admiration for the Creator of all things. John found the natural beauty of the Sierra Nevada mountains in California to be the grandest cathedrals in which to worship God. Reflecting on his studies in botany, he wrote, "Like everybody else, I was always fond of flowers, attracted by their external beauty and purity. Now my eyes were open to their inner beauty, all alike revealing the glorious traces of the thoughts of God and leading on and on into the infinite cosmos." In March of 1867, when he was 28, Muir had an accident that changed his perspective on life and the world around him. A tool he was using slipped and struck him in the eye. He was confined to a darkened room for 6 weeks and wondered if he would ever regain his sight. His sight did return, and the experience changed the way he saw his purpose in life. He later wrote, "This affliction has driven me to the sweet fields. God has to nearly kill us sometimes to teach us lessons. I bade adieu to all of my mechanical inventions, determined to devote the rest of my life to the study of the inventions of God." From that point on, he followed his dream of exploration and study of plants. He began a wandering walk to Florida. Once there, he caught a ship to Cuba and then to New York. And then he booked passage on a ship to San Francisco, arriving there in March of 1868. He headed for the Yosemite Valley and spent the months of April, May, and June there. In 1869, he spent the summer shepherding sheep in Tuolumne Meadows in the High Sierra Country. He began hiking, climbing, and studying nature in the Sierras. When he left the High Meadows at the end of the summer, he descended into Yosemite Valley. It was, Muir wrote, "by far the grandest of all the special temples of nature I was ever permitted to enter." As he explored the valley and surrounding area, he later recorded, "I drifted from rock to rock, from grove to grove. When I discovered a new plant, I sat down beside it for a minute, or a day, to make its acquaintance and hear what it had to tell. I asked the boulders I met whence they came and whither they were going." In everything he saw, Muir believed he was witnessing the work and presence of God. "Heaven knows," he wrote, "that John the Baptist was not more eager to get all his fellow sinners into the Jordan than I to baptize all of mine in the beauty of God's mountains." In 1870, Muir wintered in Yosemite. One day, hiking in deep snow to a ridgeline in hopes of seeing an avalanche, he instead became part of one. Somehow, Muir survived being swept several thousand feet down a canyon on a cascade of snow and ice. He described his experience as the most spiritual and exhilarating of all the modes of motion I have ever experienced. Elijah's flight in a chariot of fire, could hardly been more gloriously exciting. Well, these experiences in Yosemite were the beginning of John Muir's lifelong dedication to saving and preserving superlative landscapes for all people to enjoy. His motivation was based on his reverence for God, the creator of all this beauty. In 1871, Ralph Waldo Emerson came to Yosemite to be guided through it by Muir. He encouraged Muir to give up his reclusive life in Yosemite to teach or to write. And Muir wrote, "Oh, these vast, calm, measureless mountain days, inciting at once to work and rest, days in whose light everything seems equally divine, opening 1,000 windows to show us God." In 1874, an interesting date, the Overland Monthly, also an interesting magazine, began publishing a series of articles by John Muir entitled Studies in the Sierras. In 1890, Muir and others were successful in getting Congress to set aside 1,500 square miles as Yosemite National Park. But the West was being settled and tamed. Muir was concerned. He began advocating for more parks. In 1903, President Roosevelt visited Muir in Yosemite and toured and camped with him for 3 days. On the third night, with President Roosevelt as his captive audience, Muir made a plea for Yosemite wilderness preservation and for setting aside other areas in the United States for park purposes. Muir's main focus was not only the need for forest preservation, but his concern that Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Grove of giant sequoias, previously granted to California as a state park, be reseeded to the United States for inclusion in the national park. In 1906, Congress passed a joint resolution making those lands part of Yosemite National Park. He also began advocating for a government agency to administer the parks. John Muir died on Christmas Eve, 1914. Less than 2 years later, the National Park Service was created. And here is what Muir wrote that was used to open Ken Burns' PBS series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. "One learns that the world, though made, is yet being made, that this is the morning of creation, that mountains long conceived are now being born, brought to light by the glaciers, channels traced for rivers, basins hollowed for lakes. When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. The whole wilderness, in unity and interrelation, is alive and familiar. The very stones seem talkative, sympathetic, brotherly. Everybody needs beauty as well as bread, places to play in and pray in, where nature may heal and cheer and give strength to body and soul alike. The natural beauty is made manifest in our magnificent national parks, nature's sublime wonderlands, the admiration and joy of the world." Well, John Muir was not the first person in the modern era to think of the natural world as a revelation of the Creator. In early 1836, American painter Thomas Cole was desperate to create a painting for the annual exhibition of the National Academy of Design, of which he was a founding member. He decided to paint a landscape which he had sketched several years before. He had made his reputation and living as a painter of landscapes, but in his own mind, Thomas Cole believed himself to be a religious painter. He dreamed of the day he could stop painting landscapes and paint just religious scenes. Some of his religious paintings are the Garden of Eden, seen here, Hagar in the wilderness, and the angels appearing to the shepherds. But the landscape Cole produced for the exhibition, which he formally titled View from Mount Holyoke, Northampton, Massachusetts After a Thunderstorm, and is more popularly called the Oxbow, was a sensation and it had such an effect on the artistic world that it launched what has become known as the Hudson River School of Landscape Painters. In January of 1836, the American Monthly Magazine published an article by Cole entitled Essay on American Scenery, in which he laid out his perspectives on how essential the preservation of wild scenery is to the well-being of mankind, and how important it was for his fellow landscape painters to reveal the eternal's glory hidden in nature. In his essay, he affirmed the world's purpose. It has not been in vain. The good, the enlightened of all ages and nations have found pleasure and consolation in the beauty of the rural earth. Prophets of old retired into the solitudes of nature to wait the inspiration from heaven. It was on Mount Horeb that Elijah witnessed the mighty wind, the earthquake, and the fire, and heard the still small voice. That voice is yet heard among the mountains. St. John preached in the desert. The wilderness is yet a fitting place to speak to God. He who looks on nature with a loving eye, in gazing on the pure creations of the Almighty, feels a calm religious tone steal through his mind. And when he has turned to mingle with his fellow men, the chords of which have been struck in that sweet communion cease not to vibrate. Those scenes of solitude from which the hand of nature has never been lifted affect the mind with a more deep-toned emotion than aught which the hand of man has touched. Amid them, the consequent associations are of God, the Creator. They are his undefiled works, and the mind is cast into the contemplation of eternal things. Nature has spread for us a rich and delightful banquet. Shall we turn from it? We are still in Eden. The wall that shuts us out of the garden is our own ignorance and folly. May we at times turn from the ordinary pursuits of life to the pure enjoyment of rural nature, which is in the soul like a fountain of cool waters to the way-worn traveler. And let us learn the laws by which the Eternal doth sublime and sanctify his works, that we may see the hidden glory veiled from vulgar eyes. Well, like nearly everyone else in New England, Thomas Cole was raised in a congregational church community. With its Calvinist roots, one might think that the austere teachings of John Calvin would have taught him to disregard the things of the earth and focus on the things of heaven. But in painting the oxbow, Cole inserted into his landscape religious elements pointing to the awesomeness of God as creator. And this perspective was not at all at variance with what John Calvin taught. In his Institutes of the Christian Religion, Calvin wrote that we know the most perfect way of seeking God is for us to contemplate him in his works whereby he rendered himself near and familiar to us and in some manner communicates himself. In a preface to a French translation of the New Testament prepared by his cousin, Calvin wrote, "It is evident that all creatures, from those in the firmament to those which are in the center of the earth, are able to act as witnesses and messengers of his glory to all men, to draw them to seek God, and having found him, to meditate upon him and to render him the homage befitting his dignity as so good, so mighty, so wise a Lord who is eternal. Yea, they are even capable of aiding every man wherever he is in this quest. For the little birds that sing, sing of God. The beasts clamor for him, the elements dread him, the mountains echo him, and the fountains and flowing waters cast their glances at him, and the grass and flowers laugh before him." An early Calvinist creed declared, "We know God by two means. First, by the creation, preservation, and government of the universe, which is before our eyes as a most elegant book, wherein all creatures, great and small, are as so many characters leading us to contemplate the invisible things of God, namely, his eternal power and Godhead or divine nature, as the Apostle Paul said in Romans 1:20. And secondly, we know him by his holy and divine word." Even the iconic Puritan preacher Jonathan Edwards saw God's glory exhibited in the natural world and drew inspiration from it. God's excellency, his wisdom, his purity and love seem to appear in everything, in the sun, moon, and stars, in the clouds and blue sky, in the grass, flowers, trees, in the water, and all nature, which used to greatly fix on my mind. I often used to sit and view the moon for a long time, and so in daytime spent much time in viewing the clouds and sky, to behold the sweet glory of God in these things, in the meantime singing forth with a low voice my contemplations of the Creator and Redeemer. Well, in the middle of the 17th century, it was clergy who were researching and writing books about natural science. English Puritan minister John Ray wrote many scientific books, including, in 1691, a book entitled The Wisdom of God Manifested in the Works of Creation. In 1802, Anglican minister William Paley published a book entitled Natural Theology, or Evidence of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity Collected from the Appearances of Nature. The Calvinist tradition also placed high value on stewardship of all that one possessed. In his commentary on Genesis, he stated, "Let him who possesses a field so partake of its yearly fruits that he may not suffer the ground to be injured by his negligence. But let him endeavor to hand it down to posterity as he received it, or even better cultivated. Let everyone regard himself as the steward of God in all things which he possesses." And this echoes the passage in Leviticus 25:23. "Your land must not be sold on a permanent basis because you do not own it. It belongs to God, and you are like foreigners who are allowed to make use of it." As the seeds of the conservation movement were sprouting in the Calvinist Congregational Church and town meeting culture of New England, landscape painters did their part to illustrate God's handiwork and fire the imaginations of the people. Those who explored the expanding frontiers of the nation took landscape painters with them. Artists Albert Bierstadt and Thomas Moran gave the American people a glimpse of the amazing natural grandeur that lay west of the Mississippi. Early leaders in the conservation movement were New Englanders, brought up in the congregational churches and learning the Calvinist values of reverence for the creation and stewardship of all that God has given us. George Perkins Marsh, who wrote Man and Nature in 1864, Frederick Billings, and Frederick Law Olmsted all came from New England towns. These men and others of their generation formulated a powerful conservation ideology for agriculture improvement, forest conservation, and parks, and vigorously worked to realize their visions of a righteous, moral, and democratic society. Olmsted became the foremost landscape architect and park planner of his day. In 1850, he set sail for England to take a walking tour of England and Scotland and make notes on agricultural practices for articles in the Horticulturalist magazine. However, after disembarking in Liverpool, he was directed to visit a new public park in Birkenhead, the first anywhere in the world that had been developed with public funds. He was fascinated by its playgrounds, winding paths, little lake, and the presence of people of all classes and ages. He reported, "5 minutes of admiration and a few more spent studying the manner in which art had been employed to obtain from nature so much beauty, and I was ready to admit that in democratic America there was nothing to be thought of as comparable with this people's garden." 7 years later, in 1857, Olmsted found himself as the landscape architect for New York's Central Park. In the plan they produced for the park, Olmsted and his associate, Calvert Vaugh, consciously translated the Hudson River School painter's principles into an actual landscape. Through New Englanders like Olmsted, the landscape values emanating from New England towns and churches manifested themselves in state and national parks. When Yosemite was originally set aside as a California state park in 1864, Olmsted was named the head of the Yosemite Commission. Sarah Jane Clark Lippincott, the great-granddaughter of Puritan preacher Jonathan Edwards and editor of the children's magazine The Little Pilgrim, wrote an account of the pilgrimage she made in 1872 to the sacred Sierra. Yosemite, she wrote, was the temple of nature's ancient worship, with thunderous cataracts for organs and silver cascades for choirs and wreathing clouds of spray for perpetual incense and rocks 3,000 feet high for altars. Connecticut Valley Congregationalists continued to lead the American Parks movement. Ferdinand Hayden and Cornelius Hedges of Westfield, Massachusetts, were the principal proponents of Yellowstone National Park, established by Congress in 1872. George Bird Grinnell, a Yale graduate and grandson of a Congregational minister, led the creation of Glacier National Park in 1910. Stephen Ting Mather, a deeply religious man and descendant of several Connecticut Congregational ministers, was the driving force behind the creation of the National Park Service and the principal author of the bill passed by Congress in 1916 creating the service was Frederick Law Olmsted, Jr. However, beginning with John Muir's generation, Presbyterians began to eclipse New England Congregationalists in terms of their role in conceiving and implementing national laws, policies, and agencies advancing conservation, parks, and forestry. Between 1885 and 1921, Presbyterians held the White House for 28 out of 36 years in the persons of Grover Cleveland, Benjamin Harrison, Theodore Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson. And between 1889 and 1946, Presbyterians headed the Department of the Interior for 43 of those 57 years, and the Department of Agriculture for 38 of those years. The litany of accomplishments of these administrations is hugely impressive and help inform and foster the emerging environmental movement which followed. But now let's shift gears. Enough on this background. The real question is, what does the natural world reveal to us about God? I think each person answers this question for him or herself. I think the expressions I have shared from various people reflected their very individually personal experience with the natural creation around them. So I will take a few minutes to share what the book of nature, the scripture of nature, communicates to me about our Creator. To me, the natural world reveals God's love, care, and provision for us and all of his creatures. God's love for his creatures is shown that in forming the earth, he provided in it all that his creatures would need to sustain life, develop, and grow. Earth teems with life, sustained by very complex systems that provide light, air, heat, water, and food, all in exquisite balance. It shows evidence of having been specially designed to accommodate living things comfortably, like a magnificent house. Among the many precise conditions vital to life on Earth is the amount of light and heat received from the sun. The Earth's distance from the sun, its rotation every 24 hours with alternating light and darkness, and the tilt of the axis provide for a daily and annual balance of radiant heat. These features mean the sun gets only a small fraction, or the Earth gets only a small fraction of the sun's energy. But what if the Earth rotated on its axis, say, only once a year? It would mean that the same side of the Earth would be facing the sun all year. That side would likely become a furnace-like desert, while the other side would likely become a sub-zero wasteland. Few, if any, living things could exist in those extreme circumstances. The atmosphere also factors into maintaining the balance of radiant heat received from the sun. The atmosphere insulates the Earth, retaining warmth and protecting us from the cold of space. It has a perfect balance of gases necessary for life, although human activity appears to be altering that balance significantly. Lightning causes the nitrogen in the air to form compounds with oxygen, which then fertilize our soil when it comes to earth in rain. And the ozone layer filters out harmful radiation from the sun. The atmosphere also shields the earth from meteors. Generally, they burn up as they pass through the atmosphere. When was the last time you thought about all of these purposes which the atmosphere plays and about how carefully God prepared your earthly habitation? Most of us appreciate the atmosphere on a daily basis by the beauty it provides in sunsets, sunrises, cloud patterns, moonlit nights, and starry skies. God not only made the atmosphere functional, but he also made it to be beautiful so that we can enjoy it. Water is truly amazing. It is the most abundant substance on earth and has many properties essential for life. To me, its most amazing property is that it occurs as a solid, liquid, and gas, all within Earth's normal temperature range. Think of what this has meant to the technological progress of civilization in terms of water power and transportation, steam power, and food preservation. Water will dissolve more substances than any other liquid. All living things are dependent on it to dissolve the substances on which they feed. Water is also extraordinary in the way that it freezes. As water in lakes and seas cool, it becomes heavier and sinks. This forces the lighter, warmer water to the top. Yet when the water reaches its freezing point and becomes solid, it is lighter and floats. The ice acts as an insulator and keeps the deeper waters underneath from freezing, thus protecting aquatic life in the northern and southern latitudes. Without this unique quality, every winter, more and more ice would sink to the bottom of water bodies in these latitudes, where the sun's rays could not melt it the following summer. All aquatic life in these bodies would perish. These amazing properties of water speak loudly to me about intelligent design, the work of a creator. To me, the whole natural world proclaims God's existence and his love, care, and provision for his human creation and all other living parts of his creation. How perfectly he designed it. The natural world also teaches me that there are natural consequences for both good and bad decisions and actions. God has designed the world so that there is a system of checks and balances called natural consequences. It works in the physical world as well as in human society. Sometimes things appear to be a bit out of balance, generally because man, through his ingenuity, manages to delay or temporarily avert the natural consequences of his action. But there comes a time when consequences cannot be denied their lawful operation. There is a justice to this system. Natural consequences teach, or should teach, discipline, accepting the reality of the way things work and working with rather than against the laws of the universe. By having a system that operates by laws, God has designed mankind's habitation in a way that it is a self-teaching system, teaching by experiences. Natural consequences are occurring. Human activity is adversely affecting Earth's natural systems, overloading them beyond their ability to restore themselves. Ignorance and greed have led to water pollution, air pollution, and toxic chemicals in the food chain. While advances were made in this country in the 1960s and 1970s to regulate human activity and improve the quality of the environment, political forces today are rolling back regulations designed to protect our air and our water. Consequences will result. There is no way to avert them. Mark Twain once wrote with great sarcasm about the futile human efforts to try and control the Mississippi River. The river follows the laws of gravity and not nature, and not the wishes of men. And this is what he wrote. The military engineers of the United States River Commission have taken upon their shoulders the job of making the Mississippi over again, a job transcended in size only by the original job of creating it. They are building wing dams here and there to deflect the current and dikes to confine it in narrower bounds and other dikes to make it stay there. And for unnumbered miles along the Mississippi, they are felling the timber front for 50 yards back with the purpose of shaving the bank down to low water mark with the slant of a house roof and ballasting it with stones. One who knows the Mississippi River will promptly aver, not aloud but to himself, that 10,000 river commissions with the minds of the world at their back cannot tame that lawless stream, cannot curb it or confine it, cannot say to it, go here or go there and make it obey, cannot save a shore which it has sentenced, cannot bar its path with an obstruction which it will not tear down, dance over, and laugh at. Natural consequences teach us great lessons. The natural world also displays the magnitude of God and his love for order and organization. Our Milky Way galaxy contains over 100 billion stars. The diameter of our galaxy spans so vast a distance that if you could travel as fast as the speed of light, it would take you 100,000 years to cross our galaxy. Our Milky Way galaxy is 600 quadrillion miles in diameter. The average distance between stars within the galaxy is said to be about 6 light years, or 36 trillion miles. So many galaxies have now been detected that it has been said that they are about as common as blades of grass in a meadow. About 10 billion galaxies are in the observable universe. These awesome galaxies are not scattered haphazardly in space. Instead, they are arranged in definite groups called clusters. The Milky Way, for example, is a part of a cluster of about 20 galaxies. There is even evidence that the clusters themselves are arranged in superclusters. In our solar system, the planets move around the sun with such precision that astronomers can accurately predict where they will be at any time in the future. Dr. Wernher von Braun said, "The natural laws of the universe are so precise that we have no difficulty building a spaceship to fly to the moon and can time the flight with the precision of a fraction of a second." These laws must have been set by somebody. Our entire experience in life teaches us that everything organized must have an organizer. Consider the magnitude of God in some of the smallest features of his creation. Consider photosynthesis, the formation of carbohydrates in the chlorophyll-containing tissues of plants exposed to light. This is nature's food-producing process. It takes place in tiny cell bodies called chloroplasts. They are so small that 400,000 of them could fit on the period at the end of a sentence. Yet within these chloroplasts, there are about 70 separate chemical reactions that take place in photosynthesis. Everything works together in the right order to produce the basic organic building blocks of our world. Did it just start happening, or did an intelligent being design it? The natural world also shows me God's appreciation for the beauty of variety and diversity. Why is there more than one kind of tree, one kind of bird, one kind of fish? The natural and human creation teaches us that God appreciates variety and diversity. John Wesley, founder of the Methodist denomination, made an interesting observation. If there be 8,000 species of insects, who is able to inform us of what use 7,000 of them are? If there are 4,000 species of fish, who can tell us of what use are more than 3,000 of them? Consider how little we know of even present designs of God, and then you will not wonder that we know still less of what he designs to do in the new heavens and the new earth. One of the wise benefits of having a wide variety of plants and animals with differing growth patterns and resource requirements is that it assures survival of life after natural catastrophes. The variety of plants and animals made necessary a variety of environments and ecosystems. Would we wish the whole land surface to be a desert, forested, mountainous? We appreciate the beauty of God's creation because of this variety, including the diversity of the human family. God has also arranged for diversity in the church. He develops each member in a unique social environment. Variety leads to balance, harmony, and beauty. This is what the Apostle Paul wrote in Ephesians, the 4th chapter. You all belong to one body, of which there is one spirit, just as you all experienced one calling to one hope. There is one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, one Father of us all, who is the one over all and the one working through all and the one living in all. Naturally, there are different gifts and functions. Individually, grace is given to us in different ways out of the rich diversity of Christ's giving. His gifts to men were varied. His gifts were made that Christians might be properly equipped for their service, that the whole body might be built up until the time comes when, in the unity of the common faith and common knowledge of the Son of God, we arrive at real maturity, that measure of development which is meant by the fullness of Christ. The natural world also shows that God appreciates his creatures working together for the common good. In the natural creation, we recognize what is known as symbiosis, the intimate living together of two dissimilar organisms in a mutually beneficial relationship. Certain plants and animals need each other to exist. Stinging ants live in the hollow thorns of acacia trees. They keep leaf-eating insects off the tree, and they cut up and kill vines that try to climb on the tree. The tree secretes a sugary fluid that the ants relish, and it also produces a small false fruit, which serves as food for the ants. Well, we might ask, did the ant first protect the tree, and then the tree rewarded it with fruit? Or did the tree make a fruit for the ant, and the ant then thanked it with protection? Or did it all chance to happen at once? I think these kinds of symbiotic relationships display a grand design and the fact that cooperation among the elements of creation is valued by its grand designer. There is the cooperative relationship between insects and plants in the pollination process. There is also the balanced relationship between plants, which utilize carbon dioxide and give off oxygen, and animals, which utilize oxygen and give off carbon dioxide. Can you imagine that balanced relationship happening by chance? So in summary, the world teaches me that God values partnerships, working together, helping one another. God intends it to work that way among people, too. One final story. The influence of one life upon another is wonderfully demonstrated in the story behind the establishment of Rocky Mountain National Park. Enos Mills, who you see in this picture, was born in Kansas in 1870. At the age of 14, he left his family and moved to Colorado, establishing a homestead near Long's Peak, just south of today's Estes Park, Colorado. The next year, at age 15, he climbed the 14,255-foot peak by himself. During his lifetime, he climbed the mountain by himself 40 times and nearly 300 times guiding others. In 1889, He had a chance encounter with John Muir on a San Francisco beach. It changed the direction of his life. He dedicated himself to campaigning for the protection of outstanding landscapes, writing and lecturing to build public support. His speeches focused on the life cycle of trees, forestry practices, the lives of wildlife, and the preservation of natural lands. In his speeches and writings, he encouraged people of all ages to get outside to appreciate the natural world. Enos Mills was the driving force behind the effort to persuade Congress to establish Rocky Mountain National Park in 1915, and he is known as the father of the park. He wrote, "Without parks and outdoor life, all that is best in civilization will be smothered. To save ourselves, to prevent our perishing, to enable us to live at our best and happiest, parks are necessary. Within national parks is room, glorious room, room in which to find ourselves, in which to think and hope, to dream and plan, to rest and resolve." Henry David Thoreau expressed similar thoughts when he wrote, "We need the tonic of wildness to wade sometimes in the marshes where the bittern and meadowhen lurk, to smell the whispering sedge where only some wilder and more solitary fowl builds her nest, and the mink crawls with its belly close to the ground. We can never have enough of nature. In wildness is the preservation of the world." I think the energizing thing about the stories of those who had a role in launching conservation and wilderness preservation efforts in America is their acknowledgement of the sacred and divine in those places, their continuing sense of wonderment, and the excitement over the mysteries yet to be discovered and understood. John Muir expressed it this way, "I used to envy the father of our race, dwelling as he did in contact with the new-made fields and plants of Eden, but I do so no more, because I have discovered that I also live in creation's dawn. The morning stars still sing together, and the world, not yet half-made, becomes more beautiful every day."